Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and this is another beautiful spring day in Iowa that we're recording this. Not sure when you'll be listening to it, but hopefully it's beautiful wherever you are. Our guest today is Annette Libeskind-Berkowitz, and she is the author of two acclaimed memoirs, In the Unlikeliest of Places, How Nachman Libeskind Survived the Nazis, Gulags, and Soviet Communism, which was a story of her father's survival, and Confessions of an Accidental Zoo Curator, which I think is her own story, and I'm going to ask a little bit about that, too. She has also penned a poetry book, Aritha Thalassa, Brain Disrupted. The Corset Maker is her first novel. To learn more about her, you can go visit her website, which is AnnetteBerkowitz.com. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Annette.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Monica and Caroline.
And I feel like, have we spoken before about your poetry book?
Yes, we did.
That's what I thought.
Good interview. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I really enjoy speaking with you.
That's wonderful. I'm thrilled to have you back. And that was, you know, you wrote a book of poetry about your son's. It was your son, right? Who had a medical situation.
Yes, he had a devastating stroke, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So now you're turning to your kind of, this is a novel, The Corset Maker is a novel, but it also is based on some family history, correct?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that. Yes.
My mother was a fascinating woman to me all my life. She had always wanted to be independent, and she came from a Orthodox Jewish home in pre-World War II Warsaw, Poland. The role of women at the time was really to tend the home fires and to raise children. But my mother wanted more than that. So, quite incredibly, at the age of 17, she opened her own corset shop. She had been learning to sew from her mother since she was a little girl. So she knew how to design and make brassieres and corsets. And she had really the audacity to recruit her best friend and to open a store in the most elegant street in Warsaw, which, for those people who don't know anything about Warsaw or Warsaw, Poland before the war, it was very, very vibrant and elegant. People called it the Paris of the East. And here you have this young girl opening her own business. And she was very successful. And she continued to be successful later on in life in very different circumstances. But I always wanted to know more about her. And my mother was quite introverted. So I didn't get a lot of information. After World War II, when she discovered that her own mother and her four younger sisters were murdered by the Nazis, she became more withdrawn and more depressed and not as easy to share about her life. So I always thought I would do it later, but one should never put these things off because she became very ill with cancer and she passed away much too soon. So I had only little bits and pieces of information about her and three of her wonderful, courageous women friends of that same period. Later on, after my mother passed away, my father found miscellaneous pages of a book that she had been writing when he was cleaning out her bureau. And he put those pages together into a little booklet. And I read them, and they were extremely moving and very philosophical. And it made me even more curious about my mother. So I might have, under other circumstances, written a memoir, but I decided that I honestly did not have enough information. to write an honest memoir. So I thought, well, I'll just take the bits and pieces that I do know, and I'm going to weave them into a novel. I hadn't written a novel before, and I wanted to challenge myself. So I used what I knew about my mom and about her very brave friends. And so the corset maker came into being, and, you know, the real corset maker behind it is my mother.
So all the way through the book, I'm asking myself, which of the events were based on your mother and which on her friends? And it just, I mean, I'm so curious about that. Do you mind sharing? For example, did your mother actually go to Palestine?
Yes. I will share what I can share without
too much away.
any spoilers.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
There is some mystery about certain aspects in the book, so I don't want to spoil it for readers. But yes, the first part of the book, when my protagonist, Rivka, when she's young, and her interactions with her best friend, that's all based on my mother. That's all true. Then when the novel moves further on, yes, my mother did go into Palestine illegally. That part is true. It's true that she went to find her sister. That part is true. And then the events during the Spanish Civil War, those are all based on my mother's close friend, Ruth, whom I heard about before I came to America, but I actually met her in New York, my very first Thanksgiving in the United States. And I'm discovering what Thanksgiving was with my mother's friend, Ruth. She introduced me to her, and I had a chance to learn her story and meet her husband, who was a Spaniard. So her story, that part is true. The post-war in Paris is really my imagination, my wishful thinking of what would have happened to my mother had she not been subject to imprisonment in the Soviet gulags. So that's just my creative juices flowing.
Wow. So, yuck. So where were you born? Annette?
I was born in Central Asia, in what is now an independent country, Kyrgyzstan. So my first memory is of the foothills of the Himalayas.
Wow. And of course, that's not that far, I guess, from Ukraine and everything that's going on over there.
I'm glad you brought Ukraine up, because I'm going to talk about it in a minute, but I do want to say it's not close to Ukraine.
It's
actually
not, okay.
I was born 40 miles from the Chinese border, and it's just north of Afghanistan. So
okay. So how did your mother end up there?
Well, my mother was imprisoned. She was a refugee, which is, so my story, by the way, I'm going to digress for one moment. My coming of age memoir titled Aftermath, Coming of Age on Three Continents, is coming out in September.
Oh, wow.
So that'll be there in more detail for any reader who would like to know more. But my mother was a refugee. Both my parents were refugees. They didn't know each other at the time, but they were refugees from Poland who escaped to the Soviet Union when World War II broke out, and they were promptly arrested and sent to prison camps. And so when the Polish citizens were released from the prison camps, and I believe it was 1942, following an agreement between Stalin and the Polish government in exile, most of them tried. The war was raging on all sides, so their safest route was to go south, but they also wanted to go south because it was warm. And, you know, my mother had survived Siberia without shoes on, my dad, you know, tramping through the snow with her feet wrapped in paper and tied with string. So everybody wanted to go where it was warm, so they went south. But of course, the Himalayas thwarted their progress southward. So that's where my parents met, and that's where I was born. And after the war, my family returned to Poland, hoping to find surviving relatives. And then the borders closed, and we couldn't leave. So my early years, my first 10 years, I grew up in Poland. So.
And what I'm curious about is why you chose not to follow your mother's story to Siberia in the corset maker.
Because I didn't have enough facts. Mm. And I also, there was another facet to this, which is I have long been fascinated by that entire period, say from 1936 to 1946. It's a decade. It was probably the most violent decade in history. When you look at the statistics, they just blow your mind. 84 million people perished during that time. And my thought had always been, how do people survive that much violence? What personal characteristics does it take to survive such a bloody period? And most especially, how do women survive? So women's survival and war and violence, that was very much in my mind. It was a topic I wanted to explore. And I felt in a novel that's wide-ranging, because I know people that had gone through, for example, the anti-Semitism pre-war Poland and then ended up in the Arab-Jewish conflict in Palestine and then Spain and then France under the Nazis. It happens. People went from one tragedy to the next. And I was wondering, well, what does it take to make it through and emerge a whole person?
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about Palestine, because this was really eye-opening for me. So in The Corset Maker, your heroine, Rivka, goes looking for her sister in Palestine. This is before there's rumblings. I guess Hitler has risen to power. There's some rumblings. The war hasn't really started yet. And Jews were already fleeing to Palestine, but they weren't welcome there. And even though the British controlled it, they wouldn't let them in. So I didn't know that. How does this stuff not get, why is this not part of what we would learn about history?
Yeah, well, this is it. You know, we forget history. There's so much history that we don't know. And you know, I read a new survey of millennials, let's say people ages 21 to 42. They know so little history that it's just frightening. That group of people, a majority of it has never even heard the word Holocaust. So we do need to learn from history. And my sense is that learning about history from novels is much more interesting and palatable than learning facts in school and having to do a paper on a particular conflict, or reading a novel, you could relate to individuals. You can't relate to 6 million or 84 million killed, but you can relate to one person. And that's why I think novels are a good way of getting across the history.
Absolutely.
Palestine aspect, the conflict between Jews and Arabs about a tiny scrap of land is very fraught. It's very complex. Jewish people had been in that part of the world for 2,000 years. and the immigration did increase in the 20s and the 30s. There was a movement for settlers to come to the land. And initially, it wasn't that much of a problem. It's just when the population became larger, the strife over land became more violent. And so that's where my protagonist is caught.
Well, this is something that certainly has been repeated in history many times, where immigrants are welcomed until their numbers get too large. And
absolutely.
Then suddenly they're not welcome anymore. And that's exactly what happened in American history in Texas, which was part of Mexico. And the Mexican government initially welcomed immigrants and settlers from the United States to come down there. But then too many were coming, and so they closed the border and said no more. And that's when the American, North American Texans rebelled and won independence for Texas. But it was the same thing. They were actually illegal immigrants.
That's such an interesting parallel you bring up, Monica. And there are a lot of historical parallels all over the place. For example, in my book, The Corset Maker, that part about the Spanish Civil War and the volunteers who wanted to protect democracy, who streamed from all over the world to Spain to help preserve the democratically elected government. Ultimately, they failed, but they tried. This is exactly what is happening in Ukraine now. And later on in the program, happy to read a piece that sort of parallels exactly what's happening in Ukraine. The echoes of history.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And the Spanish Civil War is something else that we in the United States don't know a lot about. I think most of us wouldn't know anything if it weren't for Ernest Hemingway. Being one of the people who went and fought there.
Yes, Hemingway and George Orwell and a lot of poets and writers went there because it was the ideal of preserving democracy. But a lot of people, and I have to tell you, I didn't know enough about it myself, and I learned so much in doing the research that essentially the Spanish Civil War was a practice run for the Nazis, for the fascists, for World War II. Many of the tactics that they used in World War II were first tried in Spain. So, for example, they would gather people of a town in, let's say, in the bullring, and they would shoot them like fish in a barrel. And, you know, that was repeated many times during World War II, and the cooperation between Franco and Hitler were famous. They were basically, you know, spiritual brothers. And
Mussolini and Hitler both sent a lot of aid to Franco. But
yes,
I understand that Franco later sort of separated himself and didn't give quite the same level of assistance back. Is that true? Do you know?
During the Spanish Civil War, he got huge amount of assistance. Actually, there's a battle scene in my book where Italian weapons are involved in a battle in a key moment in the book. I don't want to say what it is, but yes, there were Spanish, there were Italian,
yes, yeah,
and German weapons used. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that what I had read, and maybe this is incorrect, but what I had read is that Hitler and Mussolini helped Franco a lot. But later on, Franco did not help Hitler as much, you know, that he kind of tried to separate himself a little bit, maybe because when he realized Hitler was losing, that he didn't.
Perhaps.
Because, you know, he was able to stay in power after World War II. Franco was.
He was in power, I think, something like 40 years.
Yeah, yeah. In fact,
yeah.
I went to Spain for the first time in 1976, and Franco had, I think, had just died not very long before that, and they had been under military rule that entire time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when the democracy loses. That's what happens.
Yeah. So I had another author whose book was set in during the Spanish Civil War, and I feel like there's a lot more material there for historical fiction to develop.
Because there's,
you know, there are a lot of books written about World War II, but not nearly as many about these other issues that led up to World War II. So to me, it was really quite interesting to learn about that.
Yes, when you take that period of the Spanish Civil War, like begins in 1936, and by that point, Hitler has risen, and his philosophy is infecting a lot of people in Europe. So the war breaks out in Spain in 1936, and it ends just a couple of months before World War II. So it was almost continuous. There was just a couple of months separation, which this is the period during which the survivors of the Spanish Civil War escaped through the Pyrenees to southern France. And then they were caught in refugee camps again. The numbers of people that lost their lives were just, I believe the numbers are something like the low estimates of the volunteers who fought in the Spanish Civil War are 6,000, and some estimates go up to as high as 25,000. So, so many people who came to defend democracy lost their lives. And I'm very fearful about what's going to happen to the volunteers in Ukraine.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Annette Libeskind-Berkovits, author of The Corset Maker. Were there a lot of Jewish volunteers in the Spanish Civil War?
There was a huge number. The number doesn't come to me offhand, but there were so many that there was a Jewish brigade formed called the Batuan Brigade. And so, yes, there was a very large number. There was a huge number of volunteers. There were, again, the estimates are inaccurate, but the number of international volunteers that came to fight for Spain range from 25,000 to 60,000 volunteers. And it's an amazing number of people of all different languages to manage and put together in language groups. It was fascinating when I did the research on that.
How did you research these two areas, Palestine and the Spanish Civil War? Did you go to original letters and source materials, or?
Oh well, I tried to find as much as possible. Thank goodness for the internet and for. Interlibrary exchanges and libraries, and research consumed a lot of my time. So it took me 4 years to write this novel, but I really enjoy the challenge of marrying together the historical facts and the creative aspect of weaving it all together.
One of the most famous parts of or events in the Spanish Civil War, of course, was the attack on Guernica.
As
that we know about because of the very famous painting by, is it Picasso?
Yes, Picasso.
Yeah, which I saw when I was in Spain the last time. And you do allude to that in the book. But some of the other things that I didn't know much about, you go into much more detail. So this battle at the Ebro? Is that what it was?
Yes, the Ebro. The Ebro River, yes.
So is that kind of, was that the turning point?
Yes, yes. After they lost the Republicans lost the battles of the Ebro, that was the end of the Civil War. They couldn't hold out. They had no weapons. They had people who were untrained. It all fell apart at the Ebro. Yes.
Wow.
I want to make sure that your listeners understand that the Spanish Civil War is just, I would say, maybe one quarter of my book.
Right.
The book is not about the Spanish Civil War. It's not even about corset making. It's about how this one woman responds, how her beliefs change over time when she experiences real life. You know, when she's a young girl in school, she gets assigned to read All Quiet on the Western Front, and she understands how useless fighting is, and she becomes a pacifist at heart. She feels conflicts need to be settled by discussion and civility, and then life happens, and what happens to her?
Right. And when she realizes there are things, times you have to fight. And we're kind of in that situation again, which you mentioned you were going to talk about, you know, with Ukraine. It's like, I'm anti-war, but you can't just look away and pretend this isn't happening.
Oh, I'm so glad you said this, because this is an idea to sum up my entire book. All one needs to do is look at the epigram in my book, which is a quote from Professor Yehuda Bauer. He's a Holocaust scholar at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. But he said this, and I will read this epigram, which readers will find right at the start of the book. Thou shall not be a victim. Thou shalt not be a perpetrator, but above all, thou shalt not be a bystander. And this really sums up the book. And this is exactly what you were just saying, Monica.
Yes, exactly. Well, Annette, why don't you read some from The Corset Maker for us?
You know, what I think I'll do first is, if you allow me, just to highlight the historical parallels and the echoes through history. On, I think it was December 10th issue of the Washington Post, says this: on February 27th, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky announced the creation of the International Legion within the Ukrainian Territorial Forces, waiving the need for visas, inviting applications through its embassies, and publishing step-by-step instructions for potential volunteers. Various foreign governments have indicated that they would look favorably upon such volunteers, and media reports indicate that thousands of people may have already enlisted. Zelensky's call for foreign volunteers as presidents, most notably the foreign volunteers who participated in the Spanish Civil War. Their history offers insight into what prospective volunteers and the world should expect. While there are practical issues and drawbacks to consider when inviting foreign recruits, such volunteers have made significant contributions in the past, both as fighters and enduring symbols of global solidarity. So that's today. And now let's go back in time for my book. This takes place about midpoint of my book. This is chapter 21, titled International Brigades Recruitment Headquarters, because Paris was the center for recruitment. And this is a piece about a character I created called Alexander Zabielski. He is a Parisian count, and he is a very important figure in the life of my protagonist, Rivka. I won't go into how and why, but he's very important. He's crucial. So here he is. He is a recruiter for the international brigades. Alexander Zabielski was grateful for the short interval of quiet as he sat at a desk stacked with papers, false passports, waiting for photos to be affixed and train tickets to be distributed. He put his feet up and lit a cigarette. Soon hordes of fresh young men and women from all over Eastern Europe would stream into his Parisian recruitment headquarters and swear allegiance to the cause. Some from as far as America, all young, Jewish girls from Warsaw with short cropped hair, wearing slacks and ties to project an image of unfussy modernity. Young Hungarians from Budapest, sick and tired of the roaming bands of Arrow Cross promoting Hitler's racial ideology. Of course, Alexander's fellow Frenchmen came in droves too, all eager to fight for freedom, to squelch Franco's fascistic moves before fascism spread all over Europe like an incurable disease. He remembered the astonished look at his own interviewer's face when he quizzed Alexander for this clandestine job. All those questions about his politics and commitment. He hadn't quite expected how difficult it would be to get through the interrogation. Karol Świerczewski, one could immediately tell from his stance he was a military man, walked into the room, bending stiffly to avoid hitting the low doorframe. He sat at the desk chair without so much as an introduction and looked Alexander over. Then the question shot out of his mouth with machine gun speed. Then this, with a big happy laugh. You, a count and a communist? That's pure nonsense. Count Zabielski, indeed. No, comrade, Alexander told him. I may be of noble blood, but don't judge me by my heredity. I want to do everything in my power to help our Spanish brethren keep their peaceful, equitable life in the villages. I know how hard they struggle to win their freedom. No bosses. Who in their right mind would object to that? Quite a lecture, Alexander. But at 35, you just may be too old to fight. We need fresh blood. Comrade Świerczewski, I can work as a recruiter. I have many connections in Eastern Europe, especially in Poland. I can deliver the fresh blood you're looking for. Poland? Świerczewski knitted his brows and seemed surprised. Yes, my family came to Paris at the turn of the century, before the Constitution of the Polish Republic outlawed the noble class and titles. Świerczewski leaned back in his chair, stretched his legs, sporting black knee-high, spit-polished boots, and looked up at the ceiling. Ah, yes, I should have recognized your Polish name sooner. You Zabielskis were quite a prominent noble family. But someone like me, who grew up dirt poor, didn't know any nobles. I'll give a damn about them. I don't give a damn about them either, comrade, Alexander said. My father and grandfather are long gone, so no more real nobles in our family. What about Countess Zabielski? How does she feel about you straying this far? I need to tell you the truth, Alexander said slowly and deliberately. Now that you brought my mother into this. The truth, eh? Mother never accepted the nobility nonsense. She's Jewish, comrade. Her nobility is in the Talmud. Świerczewski burst out laughing. Jewish? I was a Tenenbaum before I became Świerczewski. A fir tree, imagine that. You too? You're a landsman? Comrade Carol pulled out the desk drawer and pulled a bottle of vodka, passed it to Alexander with a wink. Here, take a swig. I've heard you take a nip now and then, and that you like the ladies, too. My kind of a Jew, my friend. Alexander blushed, shrugged, took the bottle. No use offending Comrade Carol. The vodka burnt pleasantly. He looked around the room. A pin-studded map of Spain and the narrow peninsula of Gibraltar connecting it to Morocco caught Alexander's eye. He said, "Do you have any news about what's happening in Madrid?" Tverchevsky did not reply. He stood up, shook Alexander's hand with a vice grip. "You're in," he said, and marched out of the room.
And that was Annette Libeskind-Berkovits reading from The Corset Maker. Now, one thing I've noticed is there's kind of throughout the book a lot about what about fashion and what people are wearing. Your heroine is a corset maker, and then she later, in later years, gets involved in the high fashion scene in Paris. You describe with great detail the clothes that people are wearing. Is this something you've always been interested in?
Well, yes, and so was my mother, because I remember still as a young girl going into my mother's corset shop. She continued her corset-making business after the war in Poland, which I might say was very unusual because in Poland, under communism, private businesses were really frowned upon. They were not welcome, and the tax authorities harassed all the private business owners, of which there aren't many. But my mother did have her shop, and I would go in, and I saw all these beautiful fabrics that she used to make the exquisite brassieres and corsets. She really had a very discerning clientele because her shop was next to a major theater in Poland, and so all the actresses were her clients. You know, that the climate in post-war Poland was such that you couldn't just, there was no department store where you could go and buy a brassiere or a corset. You had to have it made to order. So there were very few. For all I know, my mother might have been the only corset maker in the city right after the war. Yes, I saw a lot of beautiful fabrics and laces, so I was interested in it. And I actually, if I remember correctly, I opened the book in my prologue, and I do want to say something about the prologue, with my protagonist's sensibility about design. If I have a minute, I can read you the first part of the poem to kind of give the listeners a sense.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So the prologue begins like this. The noise of the demonstration disturbed Madame Bonheur's nap. She hadn't allowed herself to rest during the day until she approached 80, an age she thought as undeserved and unwelcome as a curtain call after a failed performance. If her body had cooperated, she might not have adopted such a bourgeois habit after all. "I'll sleep when I'm dead" was embroidered on one of the throw pillows scattered on the white leather sofas of her elegant Parisian apartment. A gift from someone long ago, a joke at first, that coarse American English, now defiantly displayed. She felt uncomfortable in homes furnished in ornate Louis XV furniture. All those silks, velvets, and brocades, tassels and ruffles, gilding and crystals. She did care about design and fabrics, always had, but favored them sleek and modern, white and stark, a clean canvas, nothing to remind her of the past. Let the past lie buried. That should be another pillow. Mm-hmm. So, I was very interested in the fashion of the times.
And also in the prologue, you're dealing with an issue, another modern issue of hatred and bigotry.
Islamophobia. Yes.
Yeah.
If we had all the time in the world, I'll read you the prologue. But I'll say one thing about the prologue. You know, when I was writing the book, my husband is always my first audience. When I read him the prologue. He said, you know, you should not call it the prologue. You should call it chapter one. And I said, why? And he said, people don't read the prologue. And
really?
I said, well, not. I said, really? Not the people I know. Well, then I spoke to someone else, a writing friend, actually. She said, oh, I always skip the prologue. Well, I was horrified. I was totally horrified that people skip the prologue. So I ask your listeners, if they read The Corset Maker, don't skip the prologue, because it really will change your understanding of what I'm trying to say. So I like the prologue because I have a prologue and an epilogue, and I thought of them as two very good bookends.
Right,
so, and I
right.
like the symmetry of it. So, yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't not skip a prologue because a lot of times you really don't know what's going on without the prologue.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, but I guess people do. So
I guess they do. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Annette Libeskind-Berkovits, author of The Corset Maker. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book cover. It has...
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, Monica. Yeah. The book cover is very special to me. I guess every book cover is special to every writer, but my book cover was designed by my brother. My brother is Daniel Libeskind. He is a renowned international architect. He's considered one of the small handful of best architects in the world. And, for example, he's the master planner for rebuilding Ground Zero, and he's built museums and famous buildings around the globe, I think on every continent. So to get him away from his big projects to do my cover, I thought would be very difficult, but it wasn't. He jumped into it very enthusiastically, and I think he appreciated very much that my mother is the inspiration for the book. So he did the cover, and he did it in his, I would say, typical enigmatic style. he's very avant-garde in his buildings, and he was avant-garde in his cover. So readers might not immediately understand the symbolism of the cover, but once they read it, they certainly will. The only comment I will make, other than what I've already said, is the fact that there's a swastika as part of the design. And I've heard some people, especially some Jewish people who are survivors, say, how could you, a Jewish author, put a swastika on your cover? So my answer to that is as follows. First of all, this is not the swastika that Hitler decreed. People may not know. Hitler decreed that the swastika, Nazi swastika, has to have several elements. It has to be on a red background. The swastika on my cover is on a gray background. The swastika itself has to be black. On my cover, it's white, and it has to be on a white circle, which in my case is on black. So it, of course, luckily fails all of Hitler's decrees. But it's there because antisemitism and fascism are very much the themes of the book. And also, I want the readers to understand the symbolism of the swastika and what it stands for, and many people don't. And as well, many people don't know that the swastika is a centuries-old symbol, and that it used to symbolize good, and it has been perverted by the Nazis. So that's the reason. The swastika on this cover has to be understood within the entire context of the book, not just judging it by the cover.
Well, some of the elements on the cover I understand, but I'm not sure what, you know, the rectangle with the different colored little thing. What is that?
The famous rectangle. I've been asked this by a lot of people, and I have to tell you, this is something you might enjoy. When I had my book launch a couple of weeks ago, there is a well-known sculptor in Florida. Her name is Chelsea Russo, and she sculpts glass corsets. And when she heard about my book, she said, "Oh my God, your book is about the corset maker. I will make a glass corset based on your cover, inspired by the cover." And she did. She made a fabulous glass corset. Your listeners can find it on my author website on Facebook. And a well-known actress and model, Anna Kulinova, modeled it at my book launch. It was a big hit, but it's based on that rectangle. And I cannot tell you what it is because I don't want to reveal to readers. I'll tell you this. Anybody who has read this book and wants to know what it stands for, if they haven't figured it out by then, send me a note through my author website, AnnetteBerkowitz.com, and I'll be very happy to explain it in more detail.
Well, Annette, you're going to have to tell me afterwards because I don't know what it is. And I read the entire book.
So. Okay. I will tell you. It'll be our secret.
Okay. So your publisher for this book is Amsterdam Publishing. And have you worked with them before?
No, I have not. And I have to tell you, I am so delighted that my agent hooked me up with this publisher because the publisher, Lisbeth Hink, she's based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And she is striving to be the largest publisher of Holocaust and World War II related literature. So she really loved the idea of publishing my book, but she is also going to publish my coming of age memoir, Aftermath, Coming of Age on Three Continents, which I mentioned is going to be released this September. So she is just doing an incredible job. She's been in business for 10 years, and her goal is to be the largest publisher of this type of literature and of new Jewish fiction. So I'm just delighted to know her. She's wonderful. She came from Amsterdam for my book launch, and I believe she's coming for my book launch in September, a book launch that will be done in collaboration with Studio Libeskind and the Dutch consulate in New York.
The Amsterdam publishers, in the back of your book, you list kind of the four series of books that they have. The Holocaust
yes.
Survivor Memoirs, World War II,
yes.
which are autobiographies. And then there's the
yes.
Holocaust Survivor True Stories, which are biographies. And then there's
yes.
Jewish Children in the Holocaust, which consists of
yes.
autobiographies of Jewish children hidden in the Netherlands during World War II. And then finally, the series that the corset maker is part of, which is New Jewish Fiction. And all the novels are set in time during or after the Holocaust. So this is a really, I think, perfect place for your book, isn't it, with that publisher?
I think so. I think so. She's a wonderful woman and so bright and broad thinking. I'm just happy to be linked with her publishing house.
And
I'm very happy with that.
Is your upcoming memoir, does it fit into one of these categories or is it a whole different category?
It must be one of the existing categories because my memoir basically shines a light on how children of Holocaust survivors grow up. How does their parents' experience impact on their development, on their motivation, and so forth? So, you know, I and my brother will be very much in the spotlight there.
And, you know, one thing I find interesting about your story there is that another missing part of my historical knowledge is your family were, your mother and father were Jewish, they fled Poland to Russia and were imprisoned there. So was that any, I mean, did they have it any better than if they had, than they, if they had stayed?
Well, you know, this is one of those strange turns of fate. Had they stayed in Poland, they probably would not have survived. There is a small minority that survived, but not likely. And yet, being imprisoned in the Soviet Union is what enabled them to survive. So it's a really strange twist of fate. You know, they were arrested in the Soviet Union because they said they preferred to keep their Polish citizenship, and they did not readily accept the Russian citizenship. They were given the option. Do you want to keep your Polish citizenship, or do you want to become a Russian citizen? They said, we want to keep our Polish citizenship. That's what most people said. They didn't know how long the war would last. They were wanted to go back to their home.
Mm.
But as soon as they said, I don't want to accept the Russian citizenship, next night, soldiers came with weapons and dogs and arrested everybody who didn't happily accept a Russian citizenship.
And I'm guessing
so
they didn't know that that would be the result of saying that they wanted to remain Polish citizens.
Of course not.
Wow.
Of course not.
Wow.
So that was the irony of it. You know, and in a strange way they were saved.
Yeah. So Annette, at the beginning of the show I had mentioned that your previous memoir about the zoo curation, what's it called? The
Confessions of an Accidental Zoo Curator.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I had the most wonderful job for more than 3 decades at the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York, which is the parent organization of 5 zoos and an aquarium, including the Bronx Zoo, which is world famous. And I started there as an educator and as a volunteer coordinator, but I retired as senior vice president. And I had the good fortune to develop programs that reached 50 states in the U.S. and many foreign countries, including the luck of negotiating with the Chinese government to bring environmental education into Chinese schools. My employment at the Wildlife Conservation Society gave me an opportunity to be creative, which is why I suppose I remained at my job for over 3 decades. Because creating courses, creating curricula for different audiences, everything from children to adults to professionals, teachers, and colleagues around the world, that was wonderful. So it kept me in that position for a very long time. I wouldn't say too long because I loved every minute of it. But then I retired so I could write, and I'm sometimes thinking, well, if I had done it sooner, I could have written more novels, because I found this experience of writing a novel very, very satisfying. The research, the creativity, putting it all together, it's exciting to me.
So you wrote, did you write the novel before your new memoir? The one that's coming out in the fall, or the other way around?
It's the other way around.
Yeah.
I wrote the memoir a while back. I set it aside, and then my agent said, well, do you have anything else? I bet you have something else that Amsterdam publishers might like. So I said, well, I have this memoir. And they snapped it up. But now I'm working on a magical realism novel. So I'm trying to challenge myself in new and different ways. I've written nonfiction and poetry, and a novel, historical novel, and now magical realism is on my drawing board.
Okay, that's quite a departure. Now, is it set in contemporary times, or is it set in the past or the future?
It's set in the contemporary times. It actually takes place during the pandemic.
Ah, okay. Well,
yes.
I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of literature actually comes out of the pandemic.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot because people stayed home and they face a kind of a alternate reality, which is why I'm writing it as a magical realism.
That's a very good, very good angle, very good perspective. Very good.
Yes.
And
I look forward to sharing that with you, Monica.
I look forward to reading it. Your writing is definitely draws me in. I got to admit, I stayed up until past midnight last night to finish The Course in Maker.
So. I'm sorry for keeping you up. I have a reader who sent a review saying, "You owe me 3 days." I did nothing for 3 days but read it.
Well, I want to thank you again for being with us today on Writer's Voices. And, you know, we always close with a quote. And, of course, the one that you read at the beginning is really, I want to repeat that. But then I want to read another quote, too. So the quote that's at the beginning of your book from Professor Yehuda Bauer of Hebrew University, "Thou shalt not be a victim, thou shalt not be a perpetrator, but above all, thou shalt not be a bystander," which is, like you said, really what this book is about. And then I was looking for quotes on heroism, and I found this from Fred Rogers, who is, you know, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. And I think this also fits your book very well. "Anyone who does anything to help a child in his life is a hero to me."
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
And it really, I wish I had found that one because it really, really relates to the story. Let's not say why, but readers will discover, why that's so apt. Thank you for finding it, Monica.
Well, you're very welcome. And thank you for being with us today on Writer's Voices.
It's always a pleasure.
And see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.